ultimatums, and military occupation. The failure to restore the former Shah to the Qajar throne further infuriated Russian authorities and added to their hostility toward Iran's constitutional government. Seeking another pretext to humiliate and eventually eliminate the parliamentary regime, in October 1911, the Russian minister in Tehran served an ultimatum, demanding that the Iranian government formally apologize for the insult committed against the Russian consul general or face immediate military consequences. The apology sought from the Iranian government was in response to the Majlis authorization of the Treasurer General Shuster to confiscate the properties of the treasonous Salara Doleh and his brother Shoah al-Sultaneh, the chief perpetrators of the counter-revolutionary plot. Under the pretext that the latter prince had secured a loan from the Russian mortgage bank, the Russian consul general subsequently ordered the Cossack officers to occupy the prince's residence as collateral and force out Shuster's agents who had come to appropriate the residence. The vengeful consul offered an equally fictitious claim that the prince was a Russian protege and therefore subject to capitulatory rights extended to Russian subjects. Fearful of dire consequences, the Iranian government succumbed to the threat of brute force. To appease St. Petersburg, the Iranian Minister of Foreign Affairs arrived in person to the Russian legation and offered a formal apology on behalf of his government. Yet there was no end to the demands of the two powers or their shared desire to dismantle Iran's young democracy. Almost immediately after the so-called satisfaction was given, on November the 29th, the Russian government served a second ultimatum to Iran, this time openly backed by Britain. In a rare expression of international bullying, the second ultimatum required Iran to immediately fulfill three conditions or else face Russian military occupation and, in effect, an end to its national sovereignty. It demanded that Morgan Shuster be dismissed from his post of Treasurer General, together with his American colleagues. It also demanded that in the future, the Iranian government not engage the service of foreign nationals without the consent of the two powers. Most outrageous of all, the ultimatum demanded that the Iranian government pay indemnity for the expense of the present dispatch of troops to Iran, the amount and manner of which was to be determined later. This demand was made at a time when Russia had landed more troops in Gilan and Azerbaijan provinces to reinforce its so-called zone of influence. The two powers, in effect, blatantly required that Iran reimburse the cost of the violation of its own sovereignty to an aggressor who, as it turned out, went on a rampage of massacres and maltreatment of defenseless Iranians. The second ultimatum, even more than the first, raised a storm inside and outside the Majlis, leading to a nationwide movement of outrage, speeches in mosques and the Majlis in support of Shuster, and telegraph messages of solidarity from the provinces. The Shi'i clerical condemnations of the Europeans' nefarious designs on the constitutional regime and the oppressed Iranian nation were headed by Mohammad Kazem Khorasani and his colleagues in Najaf. They called for the boycott of Russian and English goods in the bazaar, the revival of armed revolutionary Anjomans, and the elimination of the royalists. A rare voice of protest was also raised by women who, for the first time in public, acted on their own, not merely beside their male relatives, to call for a struggle against the nation's foreign and domestic enemies and support for the constitutional government and adoption of modern social and ethical values. It was as if the spirit of Mashrute had been resurrected, except this time it became painfully evident that the primary terminator of Iranian aspirations was not the Qajar regime and its clerical allies, but the dictates of European grand strategy, this even before a drop of Iranian oil had reached Europe's Great War. The 70 deputies of the Majlis, encouraged by calls to defy the Russian threat, including a women's demonstration along Lalezar Avenue, voted against the government's recommendation to accept the ultimatum just minutes before the 48-hour deadline the Russians had set. The Bakhtiari-dominated cabinet nevertheless succumbed to pressure and dismissed Shuster. Driven by realistic fears of Russian onslaught, the Bakhtiari oligarchs were also willing to comply with Russian wishes, because at the time they were negotiating with British authorities over land rights in the newly discovered oil field of Masjed Soleiman in Khuzestan province. The prospects in their tribal territory were too lucrative to be jeopardized by offending Russia, now the ally of Britain. The Majles, however, stood firm until the end. Even the disheartening news of the sudden death on December the 13th of Mahmud Kazem Khorasani in Najaf did not deter the deputies. Dying under suspicious circumstances while on his way to Tehran, Khorasani was apparently contemplating declaring jihad against Russia. Rumours in Tehran held Russian agents responsible for his death, even though tacit British blessing was not ruled out. Even if these were sheer speculations, they were enough to demoralise the public and erode support for the Majles. The Russians had no intention of coming to terms with the Majles. Since December the 1st, Russian troops had reoccupied Tabriz and gone on a rampage of plunder, rape, abduction and killing of innocent people. The Tabriz Urban Militia, the remnants of the Fada'is remobilized under the acting city council, put up a stiff resistance during 3 weeks of street battles with a Russian force of 5,000. Yet, despite nearly 800 Russian casualties, the Tabriz snipers were eventually outnumbered by Russian reinforcements of royalist Shahseven tribes. Together, they inflicted heavy casualties on the population and destroyed some of the city's most remarkable monuments, including Arg Ali Shah, the formidable 13th-century Ilkhanid citadel. Even more vicious, on the day of Ashura, September the 13th, 1912, the occupying Russian forces publicly hanged 8 leaders of the Tabriz resistance, including the enlightened constitutionalist Sheikhi Mojtahed of the city, Ali Aghor Segat al-Islam Tabrizi, 1861-1911. Their bodies remained on the gallows for days after. In due course, 36 other nationalists were hanged on bogus charges of resisting foreign occupation. By early 1912, the Russian army, then 20,000 strong, had occupied the entirety of Iran's northern provinces, from Khoi in western Azerbaijan to Sarakhs in the extreme northeastern Khorasan. Facing resistance from the population of Mashhad, who had taken refuge in the shrine of Musa al-Riza, the 8th Shi'i Imam, the holiest site in Iran, Russian field guns battered to ruin the shrine's golden dome, while invading troops looted the shrine's treasury. For the following 5 years, through terror and violence, the occupying Russian army kept a tenuous hold on the northern half of the country. Small wonder that Iranians welcomed the news of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution. Not to fall behind, Britain also brought in more troops to the south. Under the pretext of securing British interests against tribal unrest, the Sepoy detachments of the Indian Army moved up from the Persian Gulf port of Bushehr to Shiraz and Isfahan, where they faced open hostility. In both cities, bazaars were closed in protest, the Ulama boycotted British products, and a ban was observed on the sale of goods and provisions to the invading troops. The nationwide spirit of resentment of the foreign occupation went beyond the cities and into the countryside, where southern tribes, most significantly the Qashqai and the Khamseh of Fars, staged a revolt against the pro-British Bakhtiari Khans in Tehran. Yet the tribal resistance soon fizzled out in internecine rivalry and disarray. In Tehran, twice rejecting the ultimatum, the Majles in effect gave a vote of no confidence to the Premier Najaf Goli Khan Samsam al-Saltaneh, 1846-1930, the pro-British Bakhtiari Khan, who came to dominate the political stage. Irrespective of the vote, he stayed in office throughout the crisis. Earlier, on December the 24th, 1911, under enormous Russian and British pressure, and after some 12,000 Russian troops had amassed in the Caspian port of Anzali, ready to march on Tehran, the Bakhtiari Premier, aided by Yeprem Khan, had ordered the newly formed Homayoun Regiment to occupy the Majles, expel all the deputies from the premises, and close the gates. The deputies were threatened with death if they attempted to meet in the parliament or elsewhere. The cabinet had already secured the support of Abul Qasem Nasser al-Mulk, 1826-1927, the second person to occupy the office of regent to the minor Ahmad Shah. A well-versed, Oxford-educated aristocrat of the powerful and wealthy Karagözlü family of Hamadan, and a friend of both Edward Grey and George Curzon, He proved to be a learned man, but a timid statesman when it came to leading the country at a critical juncture. Fearing Russian occupation of the capital, he declared the end of the Second Majlis and suspension of the constitution under extraordinary circumstances. A committee of 5 ministers thereby accepted the Russian ultimatum and abided by its terms with minor modifications. Soon after, in January 1912, Morgan Schuster and his party of American associates resigned and left Iran, travelling in motor cars less than a year after they had arrived in horse carriages. On the eve of his forced departure, demonstrations were held in the Baharistan Square in front of the Majlis, and schoolchildren shouted, "Independence or death!" Witnessing this scene, the great bard of the Constitutional Revolution, Abul Ghassem Aref Ghazvini, 1882-1934, composed a song for which only the lyrics have survived. "Shame on the house that let the guests leave the table. Renounce life and let not the guest depart. If Schuster leaves the country, Iran will be lost. O youth of the country, let not Iran be lost. The cup of our patience brimmed, for the thief wishes to rub our house with impunity. Our story will be the shame of the world history if we allow Schuster to leave Iran." In his heart-wrenching account of the suspension of the Mashrute, Schuster himself called the destruction of the democratic experience in Iran a sordid ending to a gallant struggle for liberty and enlightenment. Reflecting on his short experience, he further wrote that the Persians were unskillful in the practical politics and in the technique of representative constitutional government, no one could deny, but that they had the full right to develop along particular lines of their customs, character, temperament, and tendencies is equally obvious. 5 years is nothing in the life of a nation. It is not even long as a period for individual reform. Yet, after a bare 5 years of effort, during which the Persian people, with all their difficulties, and harassed by the so-called friendly powers, succeeded in thwarting a despot's well-planned effort to wrest from them their hard-earned liberties, the world is told by 2 European nations that these men were unfit, dangerous, and incapable of producing a stable and orderly form of government. This was the judgment of an American in 1912, just before the disasters that befell Iran during World War I, before the British attempt to turn Iran into a semi-protectorate in 1919, and years before the Allied occupation of Iran during World War II, before the brazen Soviet attempt to snatch away Iran's territory and subvert its government, and before Schuster's own country conspired in 1953 with Britain to deprive Iran of economic sovereignty over its natural resources and its democratic aspirations. It sounds almost prophetic that he concluded that Iran was the hapless victim of the wretched game of cards which a few European powers, with the skill of centuries of practice, still play with weaker nations as the stake, and the lives, honour, and progress of whole races as the forfeit. Schuster's was not the only voice outside Iran that supported the constitutional revolution. The most courageous and consistent, perhaps, was that of the celebrated English scholar of Iran, Edward Granville Brown, 1862-1926. From the outset of the movement, Brown lent his moral support through correspondence with major constitutionalist players and sympathetic British diplomats in Iran. He also organized the Iran Committee in the United Kingdom in support of the revolution, sought out other voices of support in the West, responded to vicious attacks on the constitutionalists in the British press, and provided an updated narrative of the revolution in Iran as it unfolded. Brown's The Persian Revolution of 1905-1909, published in 1910, was a remarkable work of contemporary history based on his published pamphlets and tracts, his correspondence, and his investigative scholarship. It offered the English reader an inside view of the revolution, distinct for its direct conveyance of the ideas and feelings of the Iranians, the dilemmas and obstacles they were facing, and the prospects of their revolution, as was visible by the middle of 1909. Almost an instantaneous classic, Brown's account questioned not only the imperialist biases of his own time, but also the validity of the all-embracing critiques of Orientalism and the common assumption that Orientalists invariably were pioneers of imperial hegemony. Though Brown, like most scholars of his generation, was enamoured of a romantic vision of the East. His Persian Revolution was an anti-imperialist project that helped define the Mashrute as an authentic voice of protest against domestic oppression and foreign intrusion. That, on the cover of his book, was embossed the Persian phrase, "Long live the Iranian Constitutional Revolution, Payandebad Mashrute-e Iran," displayed the author's sympathies for the Iranian cause. It also denoted his role in representing, free of a nefarious motive, the Iranian voice against crimes committed by the great powers in Iran, even though he and a small group of like-minded liberals failed to change the course of British foreign policy. Yet his Persian Revolution was an enduring narrative for the Iranian Revolution, one that for decades defined its forerunners, heroes, and villains. Poets of Dissent and Despair. Aref's song about Shuster was part of the poetry of dissent that found expression during the Constitutional Revolution. In what might be called the poetic space, Iranians often questioned the prevailing political and religious values of their society and condemned hypocrisy, greed, and violence. With the coming of the Constitutional Revolution, the press and publications offered a new generation of poets and intellectuals a chance to free themselves from the patronage of the Qajar court and nobility and compose work in a language accessible to ordinary people. Using classical Persian forms and images, the host of poets of the period went beyond political discourse to appeal to their audiences not only through press and publications, but also through musical concerts, performances, and especially the medium of popular songs, tasnif. The message of the new poetry engaged with the revolutionary aspirations and agonies. While still loyal to such themes of classical poetry as pantheistic gazing at nature, longing for the beloved, expressing nostalgia for bygone times, and despairing over the loss of youth, the poets of the period also bemoaned the ruination of the motherland and its loss to hostile and covetous foreign powers. The glorious days of Iran's ancient past versus the cruel tyranny of its present, the grip of the greedy and corrupt elite on the people, the ignorance and bigotry of clerical leaders, the destitution and starvation, and the dark destiny that awaited Iran's immediate future were also common themes. Aspirations for progress, prosperity, and social justice were also present. They were goals that were achievable, it was thought, through mass education, modern sciences, technology, hard work, and the abandonment of past biases. Over time, such hopes turned to despair as post-revolutionary Iran plunged further into political disorder and was subjected to foreign occupation. Visitation of deadly disease outbreaks, mass famine, and destitution of the multitudes were other reasons to mourn the fate of the nation. By the end of World War I, the Iranian intelligentsia, among them a few modernist poets, wished that a savior would appear to rescue Iran and accomplish the objectives of the revolution, even at the expense of foregoing the luxury of constitutional democracy. Of seven major poets of the period, the most distinguished in poetic excellence and clarity of social message is perhaps Muhammad Taghi Bahar, 1884 to 1951, who was then at the beginning of a long and eventful political, journalistic, and scholarly career. Born in Mashhad to a literary family, he inherited from his father the title of the poet laureate, Malek al-Shu'ara, of the shrine of the eighth Imam. He soon turned to journalism and revolutionary poetry in his hometown before moving to Tehran in 1912. In a famous poem in the Mostazad style titled, "It is from us what befalls us," as Mast Kebar Mast, composed in the same year, Bahar makes a dramatic call for self-criticism, a call that touches on issues typical of the intellectuals of the period. The black smoke that arises from the roof of the motherland, it is from us what befalls us. The burning flames that flare from left and right, it is from us what befalls us. Even if we are at our last gasp, we should not complain of the stranger. We shan't quarrel with the other. But complain of ourselves, this is the core of the matter. It is from us what befalls us. We are that old plane tree who does not complain of the storm, but grows on the soil. What can we do? Our fire is in our belly. It is from us what befalls us. 10 years were wasted in disputation in the madrasa, while staying awake all night. Today we see that all was a riddle. It is from us what befalls us. We claim we are awake now. What an illusion! What is our wakefulness but that of an infant who needs a lullaby? It is from us what befalls us. We detest history, geography, and chemistry. We are alien to philosophy. But every madrasa is clamoring with he said and I say. They say Bahar is enamored of the West, body and soul, or he is a crusading infidel. We do not dispute, for it is self-evident from this point. It is from us what befalls us. At a time when the Majlis closed under the Russian ultimatum and the constitution was suspended for the second time since its inception, Bahar evidently held the Iranian political left and the right, not the aggressive European powers, responsible for Iran's plight. Typical of his time, he represents the seemingly awakened Iranian nation as an infant who listens to childish lullabies rather than maturing with the study of humanities and sciences. One of Aref's well-known tasnifs, composed on the occasion of the capture of Tehran by the nationalists and dedicated to Haydar Khan, reveals similar mournful pessimism even at the moment of victory. Two of many stanzas of this song, composed in the Dashti mode, one of the most sorrowful in the Persian Dastgah musical system, often adopted from Iran's pastoral melodies, are embedded in the Persian past, but enriched by motifs of European romanticism in mournful memory of the fallen. Of the blood of the youth of the motherland tulips bloomed, mourning their erect heights, cypresses bowed. Under the shadow of the rosebush the nightingale crept. Like me, the flower ripped apart in grief its shirt. How cruel are the heavens, how deceitful, how vengeful. The Majlis deputies are asleep, the ministers corrupt. All the gold and silver of Iran was robbed. O God, take the poor's revenge from the powerful. How cruel are the heavens, how deceitful, how vengeful. At about the same time, his disappointment with infighting among the Majlis and its parties prompted Aref to write an ode, Ghazal, reflective of the suffocating anguish for the future of the revolutionary movement. The cry of the captive bird is all for the motherland. The conduct of the bird in the cage is like mine. Think of a remedy to save your liberty, O my compatriots, for if you don't, you are a captive like me. A house that is to become prosperous in the hands of the aliens, sink that house in tears, for that is a house built on grief. It is better to put on women's garb if the aliens arrive, for there is no one more deprived in this country than women. Aref's own end was no less mournful than his poetry. At the time of his death in 1934, his passionate tone and often unrealistic, if not naive, aspirations for instantaneous democracy and freedom in his homeland had turned into an opiate melancholy. The orderly but autocratic Pahlavi rule no longer cared for him. At a more popular level, the message of despair was blended with satire and put in a language more accessible to the people of the street. This is particularly evident in the poetry of Ashraf ad-Din Ghazvini, 1870-1934, better known by his pen name and the title of his satirical journal, Nasim-e-Shomal, Northern Breeze. As the title implies, many of the themes in his poems, as well as style and subject matter, were inspired by journalistic trends from the Caucasus, and especially by the celebrated satirical journal Mola Nazaruddin, published in Azerbaijani Turkish in Baku starting in 1906. Nasim-e-Shomal successfully reinterpreted this satirical spirit for Persian tastes. In the 35 years of its irregular appearance since 1907, the modest but highly popular weekly, printed out of a small Jewish press in Tehran, reiterated in a lower register songs of nostalgia for Iran's great past, lamenting its current ruination, ignorance, and poverty. Edward Brown's rhymed rendering of the Nasim-e-Shomal piece attacking Muhammad Ali Shah just before the 1908 coup is one example. Vainly our lives to hardship we expose, while in each heart the fire of hatred glows. For while the nation doth the Shah oppose, and while the Shah supports the nation's foes, and while reaction dominates the state, needs must our caravan be lame and late. We say that now, at last, the press is free, that Persia shall regain prosperity, that firmly based is now our liberty, that colleges abound increasingly, bottles and stone best typify our state. Needs must our caravan be lame and late. An ass becomes our arbiter supreme, a dog controls each project and each scheme. A fox the object of respect doth seem, Chapshal, the Shah's Russian tutor, a trusty treasurer we deem. What pawn can move to save the king from mate? Needs must our caravan be lame and late. The prose satire of the period was no less forgiving of Iran's failings. The most remarkable, the column Sharad Parand, Sharivari, in Surah Esrafil, written by the aforementioned Dehodar, produced a penetrating and stylistically sophisticated scrutiny of the values and practices of society at this eventful time. Born in Ghazvin to a family of small landowners, Dehodar's agrarian background, early madrasa education, and short diplomatic career in the Balkans turned him into one of the best critics of his generation. With an alternative satirical pen name Daho, headman in the Ghazvini dialect, Dehodar's intimate tone and simple but piercing logic, published in 32 issues of the journal between May 1907 and July 1908, lampooned the conservative and sneered at the court and corrupt nobility, while highlighting the suffering of ordinary people and the misfortunes of the downtrodden, hungry peasants, broken artisans, oppressed women, and a host of imagined character types who appeared as the author's alter ego. It was partly because of Dehodar's contribution that Surah Esrafil reached its widest circulation of 24,000 in 1908. In the first issue, the author employs an ingenious cure for the acute problem of opium addiction in Iran to remedy problems of adulterated bread flour and healthcare for the poor. Brown's excellent translation of a short passage displays the novelty of style and content. After several years travelling in India, seeing the invisible saints and acquiring skills in alchemy, talismans, and necromancy, thank God I have succeeded in a great experiment, no less than a method for curing the opium habit. To all my zealous opium addict Muslim brethren, I now proclaim the possibility of breaking the opium habit thus. First, they must be firmly determined and resolved on abandoning it. Second, one who, for example, eats 2 mezcals, 9 grams, of opium daily, should every day diminish this dose by a grain and add 2 grains of morphine in its stead. One who smokes 10 mezcals of opium should daily reduce the amount by 1 grain, adding instead 2 grains of hashish. Thus, they should persevere until such time as the 2 mezcals of opium which he eats are replaced by 4 mezcals of morphine. By the same logic, he then proposes to Iran's statesmen that, since people are poor and cannot eat wheaten bread, and that the peasant must spend all his life in cultivating wheat, yet must himself remain hungry, they should consider the following. On the first day of the year, they bake the bread with pure wheat flour. On the second day, in every hundredweight, they put a mound of bitter apricot stones, barley, fennel flour, sawdust, lucerne, sand, I put it shortly as an illustration, clods, brickbats, and bullets of 8 mithgals. It is evident that in 100 weight of corn, which is 100 mound, 1 mound of these things will not be noticed. On the second day, 2 mounds, on the third, 3, and after 100th day, in such fashion no one will notice it, while the wheat bread's habit has entirely passed out of men's minds. After the coup of 1908 and the execution of Jahangir Khan Shirazi, the editor of Surah Esrafil, Dehodar escaped to Switzerland, but returned after the constitutional restoration to begin a scholarly career as Iran's greatest modern lexicographer. Like Bahar, he preferred to stay out of politics and, alternatively, to pursue language and literature as expressions of Iranian national identity. Pondering the secular modernity. Poetry, satire, music, journalism, and later literary studies and lexicography, remarkable though they were in defining the national culture of the period, could not fill the visible lacuna in the theoretical grounding of the constitutional order. Throughout, there was precious little articulation of political thought, democratic rule versus despotism, civil and human rights versus power of the state, legislated human law versus the primacy of divine law, and secular values of the emerging society versus requirements of the Sharia. The paucity is all the more puzzling given Iran's tradition of Islamic philosophy and its grounding in Platonic and Aristotelian thought, to the extent they were selectively known through classical Arabic translations. Moreover, Iranians had long produced in the genre of mirrors, advising rulers on the theory and practice of government. Most cursory references to such theoretical concerns, often by political activists, were to be found in musing of such writers as Malcolm Khan and Abdelrahim Talibov Tabrizi, 1834-1911, works that even at the time of the Constitutional Revolution were not widely available in print. In part, such disinterest toward modern political philosophy can be attributed to the petrified scholastic tradition which had prevailed since the late 17th century, especially in Isfahan, where students of Mullah Sadra abandoned the pursuit of political philosophy and hindered any potential for an indigenous alternative thought such as the one that flickered on the speculative horizon of their teacher. In trembling fear of jurists' censure, most philosophers of the Qajar period and the constitutional era avoided engaging, even on their own terms, with notions conducive to individual rights, toleration, and social contracts. Nor were there the forum or the patronage to translate, articulate, and indigenize such notions from European sources. Constitutionalism and its corollaries thus were seen as commodities to be imported and implemented, often regardless of their theoretical underpinnings. Before the raging debate over the legitimacy of constitutionalism, its protagonists were anxious to define it as a notion that concerned only the sphere of government and the restriction of the authority of the ruler, while in reality the adopted constitution reached beyond the political sphere into areas that traditionally were claimed by Sharia. Constitutionalists insisted that reforms to the institutions of the state would in no way interfere with Islamic principles and the requirements of the Sharia, and they repeatedly claimed that Mashrute was concomitant with the teachings of Islam and its true spirit. They dismissed anti-constitutional attacks of jurists like Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri as merely short-sighted and based on intra-clerical rivalries. Whatever the sincerity of such interpretations and its necessity so as to ward off the clerical cudgel of heresy, there was little effort in earnest to articulate theoretical boundaries of liberal democracy. In other words, Islam as a comprehensive divine order with claims over the individual, the government, and the community was never seriously dealt with in the constitutional period, nor was an effort made to spell out a workable compromise. At the time, constitutionalists did not see any urgency for speculative debates, nor could they see a paradox in complying with Islam as a comprehensive social order on the one hand and advocating secular modernity on the other. A notable exception, however, was Muhammad Hossein Naini, 1860-1936, a high-ranking jurist then residing in Najaf. During 1908, while the civil war was raging in his homeland, Naini argued in his book Tanbi' al-Omar wa Tanzi' al-Milah, Alerting the Community and Purifying the Nation, which was written in relatively accessible Persian, a rarity among jurists at the time, that constitutionalism is compatible with the teachings of Shi'i Islam. He argued that in the absence of the just and equitable rule of the Imam of the age, constitutionalism is the lesser of the evils and the most viable alternative to autocratic rule, despite its shortcomings. The deputies of the Majlis, he proposed, collectively represented an institution that, in the absence of the Imam, could attend to public affairs, so long as they acted under the supervision of the Mojtahids. Despite this notable point of departure, largely in response to Nuri and opponents of the Majlis, neither Naini or anyone else was willing to acknowledge such issues as inequalities of Muslims and non-Muslims, limitations on freedom of speech and association, gender inequality, slavery, torture, and intolerance toward non-believers. These stood in contrast to requisites for developing a tolerant, pluralistic, and inclusive society. Nor was there even the desire to articulate against the largely non-historical assumption that the Sharia held comprehensive sway over all affairs of society and the state. Ironically, with the relative growth of secular society in Iran after 1909, even Naini retracted his earlier assertions and attempted to remove his published work from circulation. Like most mujtahids, he retreated back to the traditional jurist's niche, recognizing, at times explicitly, monarchical autocracy as a necessary evil that was complementary to the jurist's supervision of the Sharia sphere. This, in essence, was what Nuri advocated, at least toward the end of his anti-constitutional struggle. Translations and adaptations of Western works of political philosophy, published in Persian before and during the Constitutional Revolution, came to substitute for the paucity of a robust theoretical discourse and helped shape the ideology and rhetoric of the revolution. One example was the translation of Abdul Rahman Kawakibi's Tibai al-Istibdad wa Masari al-Istibad, Modes of Despotism and Stages of Exclusion, an Arabic rendering of a Turkish translation of Vittorio Alfieri's Della Tirannide, published in 1800, which itself was a summary of Montesquieu's De l'Esprit des Lois. Translated into Persian under the same title by the liberal Qajar Prince Abdul Hussein Mirza and published in Tehran in 1908, it was instrumental in defining despotism and articulating the claims of constitutionalism. Legacy of the Constitutional Revolution. It is perhaps in this inadequate theoretical grounding of constitutional ideals that we should seek at least a partial answer to the Constitutional Revolution's political setbacks. Despite staging an earnest liberal movement with urban support, the Iranian constitutionalists never really succeeded in defining the relationship between the religious and the political spheres. Nor did the geopolitical contingencies of European powers allow for the natural growth and fruition of this experience. From the outset, the Constitutional Revolution faced not only opposition from the Qajar regime and the affiliated clerical conservatives, but also the growing hostility of the great powers, which together eventually brought the movement to a standstill. The predominance of the Qajar nobility, though shaken, by no means was purged. Domestic unrest, the inertia of the landowning elite who controlled the institutions of the state, and mere inexperience also bear a share of the blame. The all-embracing assault of these hostile forces demonstrates why the experience of modernity in Iran and the rest of the Middle East proved lopsided and inconsistent, and why Iran would witness two other major political upheavals in the course of the 20th century. Yet it is wrong to view the Constitutional Revolution as an outright failure, as some do. Iran in 1914 was fundamentally different from Iran of 1905. In less than a decade, not only were the two pillars of the old order, the Qajar monarchy and the Mujtahid establishment, weakened, the revolution had also managed to remove important barriers to social and cultural change. The modernizing project of the early Pahlavi era was the legacy of the Constitutional Revolution. State centralization, an integrated army, reforms in finances, civil and penal codes, and modern public education, and road and rail communication, all grew out of the debates of the constitutional period and lingered in the aims and aspirations of that era. Despite undeniable abuses of political power during the Pahlavi era, especially involving the royal court and its affiliates, notions of law and order and due process remained in place and shaped the everyday life of ordinary citizens. The ideology of Iranian nationalism and its historical narrative, moreover, was nurtured during the constitutional period. Notions of patriotism and love for the motherland, Mihan, were incorporated into the discourse of the revolution, and especially after 1909, frequent usage of national, Meli, and nationalists, Meliyun, anticipated the nationalist ideology of the Pahlavi era. Most statesmen who saw through the reforms of the post-constitutional era, including Reza Shah himself, were shaped by the experience of the revolution and burned by its political setbacks. Indeed, it was the wholesale adoption of the non-political objectives of the Mashrute, while also renouncing its liberal ideals, that bound these men together and gave them a sense of purpose. They saw their mission as the reconstruction of a new Iran through the alternative route of a strong state. In their view, this was the only way to save Iran from imperial hegemony, political chaos, and factional bickering, and the best strategy to project a vision of stability, prosperity, and power. By no means, however, did all involved share this vision of progress. The journey from the tumultuous liberal experience of the constitutional period to the positivist but rough-and-ready autocracy of the Pahlavi era had to travel a rugged path that took Iran through even darker days of more foreign occupation, regional rebellion, starvation, disease, and loss of life during and after World War I. War had raised Iranian nationalists' hopes, but also left bitter memories in the hearts and minds of many who felt robbed of the true constitutional legacy or of the true values of Islam. They saw themselves as victims not only of the onslaught of foreign powers, but also of the betrayal of the constitutionalists and later of the brute power of Reza Khan. He was seen as a usurper who had come to power on the backs of British occupiers and with the help of a privileged elite. It was these memories that were to haunt many generations of Iranians, both secular and religious, for decades to come. For some, the experience of the constitutional revolution proved that Western powers would not allow the establishment of a free and democratic regime, and that domestic political players were incapable of maintaining it. For others, the Mashrute liberal democracy was an imported commodity, even an ailment devoid of imagined authenticity. The memory of the constitutional revolution, lingering in journals and memoirs of participants and eyewitnesses, later was reconstructed as a narrative of national resistance. In the 1940s and 1950s, the Allied forces' occupation of Iran, and subsequently the oil nationalization movement, persuaded Iranian political players and observers to view their own national inspirations and the foreign intrusions as continuation of the constitutional struggle. The parallels were indeed striking, even if the agents and players were not all the same. Mohammad Mossadegh, the champion of oil nationalization, was a member of the late Qajar elite, whose worldview and ideals were largely shaped by the constitutional revolution and its prescribed parliamentary process. Nearly a quarter of a century later, Ruhollah Khomeini's doctrine of Islamic government under the guardianship of the jurist was a clear rejection of the secular liberalism of the constitutional period, and more along the lines first preached by Fazlullah Nuri and supporters of the Mashrueh. Attempts to materialize this alternative vision transformed Iran in directions strikingly different from the constitutional experience, yet it still left Iranians grappling with issues of democracy, national identity, and geopolitics, as during the constitutional revolution. Part 3. A Nation Recast. In the 7 decades following the Constitutional Revolution, the Pahlavi era, 1921 to 1979, transformed the politics, society, and economy of Iran. In the aftermath of World War I and the upheavals of the post-war period, Reza Shah's authoritarian rule, boosted by oil revenue and a consolidated military, helped centralize the country, create modern administrative and educational institutions, co-opt the old elite, nurture a nationalist ideology, and conduct a relatively independent course of foreign policy. These were achieved at the expense of democratic aspirations and individual and political freedoms that were at the core of the constitutional experience. Westernization also deepened the rift between the Pahlavi state and the retreating clerical establishment. In the aftermath of World War II, hopes for an open society and for greater economic sovereignty reignited during the short and volatile era of party politics and the oil nationalization movement under Mohammad Mossadegh. The bitter end of that episode left a lasting impact on the Iranian intelligentsia, who remained weary of foreign intrigue and arbitrary rule. The quarter of a century after the 1953 coup offered Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi a chance to augment his father's project of state modernization. A program of land reform in the 1960s and rapid growth of oil revenue in the 1970s boosted the Shah's political ambitions, his self-image as a savior of Iran, and his repressive rule. A submissive technocracy and a dreaded security apparatus enhanced his illusion of stability and sense of confidence. Yet, as early as the 1960s, opposition to the Shah and the Pahlavi order brought radical Islamic trends to the political stage. Ayatollah Khomeini's criticism of the Shah demonstrated a serious rift between the westernizing state and the radicalized clergy. Other voices of opposition, including the radical left, showed symptoms of greater crisis to come. The changing political horizons were well evident in the literary and artistic expressions of the period. Greater urbanization, growth of education, the presence of women in public spaces, greater prosperity, and the adoption of modern values and lifestyles in turn engendered both new anxieties about the loss of authenticity and a call for return to traditional values. It was as if the Iranian intelligentsia yearned for an alternative to the Pahlavi promises of glory.